When you're exploring African spirituality, you are inevitably dealing with different aspects of identity. And when it comes to issues of identity, there is no other topic more contentious to Black South Africans than the issue of surnames. In fact, matters relating to surnames have seen entire families disintegrating into animosity, bitterness, and a lot of the time, anger. When my father passed away in 2008, as a family, we were not connected to anyone else with whom we shared a surname. I was basically the only person in my family with my surname. My father's father had left him and my grandmother when my father was very young, and so my father knew next to nothing about his origins. This was made worse by the fact that my father was born in Johannesburg in the 40s, and that he didn't have any kind of connection with anyone in Makai. I have spent the last several years trying to trace my origins or to find where exactly my father's people come from. It is a tedious and frustrating job when you have almost no information to work from. For one thing, there seems to be very few people with my surname, and those that I do know, they also know almost nothing about their surname's history outside of their own immediate families. I've actually lost count as to how many times people have told me to write to Ukumbulekhaya. About 2 months ago, I got probably the biggest breakthrough so far. I was busy with research for episode 2, which dealt with the impact of early Christian missionaries on African spirituality, and I came across something called the Blue Book on Native Affairs. This was a compilation of information on colonial progress in the British colonies. It was periodically sent to Britain as a kind of a status report during the early stages of colonization. In there was an entry in the 1880 volume by a missionary who was stationed in Eastern Cape, which read like this. I am happy to say that as far as can be seen, there is a marked advance in many ways. The square house and substantially walled round hut is superseding the old grass huts, and the use of European clothing is generally more adopted. Now, let me explain why this particular quote is significant for me. My surname, Nxande, comes from the word Ixande. The word has two meanings in terms of definition and function. In terms of definition, Nxande are the four sides of a rectangular house. One side is Ixande, and the plural is Inxande. From what I could find, within Xhosa traditional homesteads, there is a house in which guests are received. This house would be like a jewel of the homestead and would be rectangular in shape and generally situated between two rondavels. This house was called Ixande. So now, here's the dilemma. If the missionaries say that they were the ones who introduced the four-cornered rectangular houses to the Xhosa people in the early 1800s, and the definition of the word Ixande means a four-cornered house, does this mean that the word Ixande came after the missionaries were already here? I checked with a friend of mine who is an architect, and he says that historically in Southern African cultures, there was no rectangular houses pre-colonization. It was mostly round or oval structures. But now, if Ixande is a house that receives guests, then that means that as a social function of Xhosa architecture, then Ixande has been around for far longer than white people have been around. And that is the challenge that I have. It's a case of the chicken or the egg. Either way, one way or another, At some point, someone in my history took the word Inglande and turned it into a surname, the surname that I carry now with me. And this led me to ask, what exactly is a surname? How did our surnames come about, and how did they evolve to become such crucial components of a social and spiritual identity? There's a difference between a name and a surname in terms of their form and their function. The first names of most African people often have deep and complex meanings. These meanings are derived from the word itself. For example, names like Lerato or Thandoluhle, which mean love or a beautiful kind of love. It is the word itself that carries the meaning. Names can also signify certain aspects relating to a person's birth. Like, some names signify prayers that have been answered, and some relate to the circumstances of a person's birth, such as natural disasters or deaths in the family or the changing seasons and so on. And it is well known that African people generally aim to give their children's name that infer positive qualities. There's a Setswana saying that goes, "Bitso lebe ke serumo," which means that giving a child a name that has a negative connotation will lead to that negativity manifesting in the child's life. Now, let's talk about surnames. Surnames as we know them today, as a matter of government policy, evolved in Europe from the Middle Ages onwards. During this time, there was no formal system with which the ruling monarchies could keep track of their citizens. Schooling was almost non-existent and most of the people were illiterate. However, Christianity, and by extension the church, was a pervasive presence throughout most societies. And by religious necessity, the church was the only physical institution that was frequented by most people. It was in the church that newborns were baptized. And it was also in the church that couples got married, and it was in the church that funeral rites of deceased peoples were performed. And if there was one thing that the church was good at, it was keeping records of all of these events. So inevitably, it was the church that could accumulate vast population registers, and by its nature, the records kept by the church needed to reflect the religious views of the church. And by this I mean that for you to be registered by the church, you had to be Christian. And in one way or another, you needed Christian names or something close enough. As for surnames themselves, European society at the time, just like most of Africa, was patrilineal. This means that it was believed that children belonged to their father's family. As a result of this, when most children were named, a reference was made to their father as a form of differentiation. For example, if William's father's name was John, then he would be called William, son of John. Over time, the son of John reference was shortened to Johnson or Williamson and so on. In Icelandic cultures, the naming reference was also used for girls as well. To this day, you can still find surnames like Simon's daughter as a surname. If the reference was not made in relation to a person's father, it would sometimes be of the person's occupation. Like John the Baker would be John Baker. If John was a blacksmith, then he would be John Smith or John Hunter or John Hunt. Some references would be related to the physical appearance, like John with the curly brown hair would be John Brown. Other times, it would be a person's location that was used as a descriptor, like John Hill or John Woods. When it came time for the church to record a baptism or a birth or a marriage or a death, these descriptors were used, especially in the cases when certain names were more common than others. The churches found that it was more efficient to keep members of one family under one descriptor. This was because naming a person after their father meant that every second generation needed a new descriptor. So it was decided that the descriptors could be carried over into multiple generations and across different genders. So John Smith's grandchildren would be called Smith as well, and thus surnames were born. The advent of colonization in Africa brought with it these very naming conventions. Throughout the establishment of colonization, churches were more common than any other colonial institution. African people were gradually robbed of their land and plunged into oppression, and it was the church that sold a Western identity as a godly identity and compelled African people to assume naming processes that reflected their embrace of Christianity through practices like baptism. But more on that later. To start digging into the history of naming systems in African cultures, I will start with probably the most famous surname out of Southern Africa. It is a surname so iconic that even in far-off countries, it conjures images of an almost mythical person. Yet, as renowned and universally recognizable as this surname is, in the context of its fame, it is a surname that actually never existed. No, I'm not talking about Mandela. Here I am talking about the infamous Shaka Zulu. At some point in the late 80s, we would gather around one of the handfuls of television sets to be found on any given street in the hood, and we waited with intoxicating excitement for Margaret Tsingana to belt out the song, "We Are Growing," or how we used to call it, "Boom, boom, 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 boom. Boom, 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 boom." The chorus spilled into our eyes the now legendary 8-pack of one Henry Cele. The hit TV series, in many ways, was ahead of its time. It was based on a novel by Joshua Sinclair, which itself was loosely based on the life of the late King of AmaZulu, Shaka. Man, the show was lit. The show hit us on the sweet spot somewhere between heart and diaphragm. It blended fact with fiction and exuded black pride in ways that Black Panther could only be envious of today. It was this intoxicating effect that it had on us that allowed it to reshape our actual history and distort our identity. The truth is, Shaka's name was never Zulu. I guess it was catchier as a book or as a television title. The reality, however, is that Shaka lived in a time when surnames as we know them today did not exist. And most of African naming practices were patronymic. Patronymic basically means that a naming system derived from the first name of a father or a male ancestor. The tradition back then was that a person carried their father's first name as their surname. Ushaka, the son of uSenzangakhona, was called Ushaka ka Senzangakhona. In turn, Senzangakhona was Senzangakhona ka Jama after his father, uJama kaNdaba. The morphing of Shaka's surname into Zulu is a testament to the impact, or rather, the consequence of the collision between African identity and colonization. This patronymic naming practice was common for centuries in Africa, especially because societies back then were deeply patriarchal. But the challenge with this system was that if my son was named after me, his kids in turn would be named after him. So there's no continuity. The reason this was never really a problem throughout African history is that Africans had become experts at developing coded languages. For the purposes of retaining history in relation to family lineages, Africans have Isibongo and Isithakazelo, or in Sesotho, Diboko le Dithoko. Isibongo is what in English is loosely translated as clan names. I say loosely because English is a malnourished language and it lacks depth. Isibongo, from the root word ukubonga, means to praise or to give thanks. It is absolutely crucial that we understand these meanings because they defined the very reason why these practices were so important, not just in uplifting the identity, but in creating a sense of pride. A clan name, in the English sense, is merely a descriptor. The function of Isibongo or Diboko, on the other hand, is not just a function to differentiate one person from another. It is to praise their existence. It is to edify their very being and to offer gratitude to God, not just for the person's life, but to honor spirituality inherent in life itself. The origins and evolution of Isibongo and Diboko differ across different cultures. I think it's important at this point to put down a disclaimer to say that the following information might differ from what you might have been told. I myself have found many varying versions of this information and have done my best to pick out the most common. If you hold a different view, please let me know in the comments so that we can all share and learn from each other. Now, when it comes to Isibongo or Liboko, the most famous ones that most people know in South Africa is Nelson Mandela, who was generally and affectionately known as Madiba. Our other beloved president, Jacob Zuma, was called Umsholozi. Isibongo within the Nguni tradition is usually the originating founding male ancestor of a particular ethnic group. This is similar to the Sotho and Tswana cultures, but more often than not, Basotho and Batswana, who subscribe to totemism, use their totems as clan names. Totemism is the belief that there exists between a social group, a clan or a family, an intimate relationship with one given natural object or an animal. And it is then decided that that animal or object will become the family's emblem. Totemism is born out of a belief called animism. And animism is the foundational belief of virtually the entirety of African belief systems, and it is basically the belief that everything in the universe holds a spiritual presence or a spiritual quality. This is from living beings like such as human beings and plants and animals, and also mountains and valleys and rivers and natural phenomena like rain and mist and storms and the changing seasons. In some Batswana and Basotho cultures, it does happen that the founder's name and a totem merge into one. For example, let's look at Basotho. One of the original tribes from which Basotho come from were the Bafokeng. In later generations, the Bakwena came to be the descendants of Bafokeng. They are a tribe named after Kwena, son of Malope wa Pili. I have to put particular emphasis on the fact that Bakwena, even though they are classified as Basotho, they existed centuries before the Basotho tribe as we know it came into existence. The Basotho as we know them today were a group of tribes that were amalgamated under the leadership of Moshoeshoe in the early 1800s. This was following the devastating effects of the Mfecane. The language that these tribes spoke was Sorolo, not Sesotho. The reason why this emphasis is so important is because the tribes that we believe we fall under, like AmaZulu and Basotho and Batswana and such, did not exist before white people came. These classifications are products of colonial convenience. The Nguni people never called themselves AmaZulu or AmaXhosa. These were small individual ethnic groups among many. AmaZulu were only one clan that spoke a derivative of a language that we know as isiZulu. There were other tribes who spoke isiZulu who were not classified as AmaZulu. It's basically like someone deciding that the people of South Africa are called Mandela and the language that they speak is called Mandela. This is basically what happened back then. As it stands, it remains debatable where exactly the classification of Basotho comes from. It's been thrown about that it originates from the Sesotho word Soto, which means brown. But it makes no sense as to why a tribe of African people would call themselves brown people. Who would it differentiate them from on an entire continent of people with an endless variation of brown skin tones? One of the greatest tragedies of the short-sighted tribalism that was imposed on us is that it created a debilitating sense of isolation. We've grown to believe that we only exist in our own little cultural bubble with thick, impenetrable walls that we call pride. Worst of all is that we as South Africans imagine ourselves far removed from the rest of the continent, especially on a cultural level. Like we somehow materialized into this country out of thin air. Let me make an example. Within the Sangoma belief system, there are many different types of AmaZulu. and there's one in particular called the Lozi. Outside of Ubungoma, this term is virtually non-existent for most people. But the Lozi are not a mythical spiritual entity. They are a living, breathing people who walk this earth just like we do today. The majority of Balozi and those who speak the language can be found mainly in Zambia and parts of Namibia, Angola and Mozambique. Let me play you this clip and you will understand where I'm going with this. This is someone speaking Silozi. If you understand any of the Sotho languages, you probably understand at least half of what this lady just said. This is a language spoken as far up as Zambia, and it lays bare the fallacies of our self-imposed cultural borders. Here's a brief history of Balozi. The Kololo or Makololo are a subgroup of the Sotho-Tswana people native to Southern Africa. In the early 19th century, they were displaced by the Zulu, and they migrated north to Barotseland in Zambia. There, they conquered the territory of the Luyana people and they imposed their own language. The combination of Luyana and Kololo languages gave rise to the current Lozi language as it is spoken today. You can read a lot into this aspect of history in terms of how all these cultures have impacted one another on a social, cultural, and even spiritual paradigm. For one thing, it is rare to hear of a tribe or clan that move upwards on the continent instead of down. It also means that in Zambia, there are people whose lineage come from Botswana and Basotho and not the other way around. This story also shows not only how intertwined our histories are across cultures, but the reality that two cultures, even those that are at war with each other, can merge, and from that, a new people are born. Now, going back to the evolution of our clans, it is logical to predict that people from one particular clan would move around and be split from the larger body. These people, for whatever reason, might settle in a different region. In such circumstances, those people might add another descriptor to their clan name. This descriptor might refer to their particular chief's name or the geographic location that they found themselves in. And this descriptor would be added in addition to the original clan name. In the case of Bakwena, for example, there are Bakwena ba Mahopa, Bakwena bo Mudisana ba Matau, Bakwena ba Morare. These would be different kinds of clans within a clan. Here's another example. The Batlaping people originate from the same tribe that birthed the Basotho people, a clan called Barolong. After Barolong settled on the banks of the Orange River, known as Kolong, fish became a staple of their diet. There were several harassing raids by the Ndebele which led to most of the Barolong moving northwards to modern-day Khanyisa. Those who were left behind stayed and fought against the raids of the Ndebele, and they were referred to from that point as those who remained behind to eat fish. Tlapi means fish, and that is how they came to be called Batlaping. These movements and changes in leadership, these emphasis on geographic locations and victories in wars and warrior chiefs would be added to a tribe's life story. And it was through this process that Izithakazelo or Dithoko were born. Me, Dingudlomo, Umadiba, Uyemiyem, Uzondwa, Sophichu, Nkolomsilo, Uvela Bampensele, Uthubane, Qumphashe, Ntande, Mthembu, Ncikhoza, Mchikalana, Malangana, Uzondwa zintshaba ezingasoze zimenze nto. And on my mother's side, Rebatlong, Rebapo, Rebinatlo, Remabia, Regadimana Ntweng, Odijong ga Regadimana. Izithakazelo or Dithoko are more than what we generally translate as clan praises. these clan names, the names of our ancestors, the locations, the drop the mic phrases at the end that fill your chest and send shivers down your spine are a living and breathing history. It is the poetry of our lives, the coordinates to the fitting rebirth of our souls. This is not some kind of advocation for a primitive form of spirituality. These are hard facts, hardwired into our DNA. And this is why Izitaka Zelo are so, so important to us. There are two historic events that occurred that had a dramatic impact on the identity and social systems of African people, especially in Southern Africa. One of them was the Mfecane, which was a period of widespread chaos and warfare among indigenous ethnic communities from the period 1815 to about 1840. During this period, many clans and ethnic groups were displaced. Some were running away from wars and others were trying to find better pastures since there had been a devastating 10-year-long drought in the area. It happened sometimes that when a larger group was on the move, either for war or for land, encountered a smaller group, a battle would be fought, and usually the smaller group would either flee or they would be assimilated into the larger group. In many ways, the Mfecane reshaped many families, especially in the sense that many clans disappeared. Many lineages came to an end. But at the same time, many more new ones were born, as is the case with the Ndebele people and many others. Some of this history can actually be found in Izitaka Zelo of many clans, especially in the references to battles fought and legendary warriors. Then, colonization happened. As I've mentioned before, for the colonization project, the church was instrumental in the process of breaking down the social and cultural identity of black people for the purpose of assimilating them into Western ideology. In episodes 2 and 3, I speak extensively on the impact of the church. In episodes 2 and 3, I speak extensively on the impact of the church on black people in those early days. By the late 1800s, churches were in charge of keeping records of the people who had been baptized. For the colonial rulers, if you were not baptized, you basically did not exist. So, baptism certificates were the first birth certificates and the first IDs. But now, for your name to be captured on the baptism certificate, it needed to fit the Western naming system of a first name, a middle name, and a surname. And up until that time, black people did not have surnames, not in the Western sense of the word. So right then, in having that missionary fill in that baptism certificate, you had to come up with a surname. And you have to remember that different ethnic groups used different naming systems, so there was no standard way of coming up with a surname. This is where much of the chaos with our surnames today began. Logically, many people adopted their clan names as their surname. Some people used parts of Izitaka Zelo Zabo as a surname. But you have to remember that converting Isibongo into a surname is a bit problematic. You and I can have the same clan name, but it does not necessarily mean that me and you are blood related. Clans were usually founded by an individual, usually a man. For whatever reason, he would gather a group of his followers, all men with their own families, and they would decide to settle at a given location. That group of people would then be known by that founder's name. But this does not mean that everyone in that clan is a blood descendant of the founder. So when people chose to use Isibongo as a surname, it created a false family connection. It must be said, however, that Africans considered their clan as part of an extended family. The issue here is that what Europeans defined as a family, namely the nuclear family, is not how Africans defined it. So in filling their baptism certificates, they had to represent themselves as coming from a nuclear family, which they didn't. Bear in mind that when a man decided to register himself using his father's name as a surname, that record was final, and it meant that his kids could not use his first name as a surname. In that moment then, one man's name becomes the surname of endless generations to come. What Africans were experiencing during this period was completely alien to them. They had no idea the extent to which they were denouncing their heritage and how far-reaching the consequences would be. But this was only the beginning. As the migrant labor system of the early 1900s took many men away from their families, many of them found themselves on farms and gold mines and being forced to adopt identities that were convenient for white people. So-called Christian names replaced people's birth names, and surnames that didn't necessarily align with a person's history were hastily jotted down by impatient clerks at municipal offices who had little regard for the person's existence, much less trying to make sure that they wrote down their surnames properly. My uncle once went to register for a pass. The surname that his family had decided on was Umlota, since they were AmaXhosa. The clerk, unbothered by the fact that he did not know how my uncle's surname was spelt, wrote down Moloto, which is a Setswana surname. So my uncle went in with one identity and came out with another. He went in as umXhosa and came out as Motswana. What many Africans tried to do was to keep their heritage of using patronymic names. As Africans interacted more and more with white people exercised a godlike sense of superiority over black people and decided that they could name black people as they liked. Many black men were given derogatory nicknames by their white employers. Over time, the descendants of those black men adopted those nicknames as surnames. And this is how surnames such as Swart Boy came to be. The socioeconomics of race also had a bearing on how black people evolved their identities. Some African people adopted English or Afrikaans surnames with the hope of passing as colored so that they could access better economic and social opportunities. Some people, through a process of phonological adaptation, took Afrikaans words and basically made them sound African. For example, the Xhosa surname Velevuta is actually derived from Vervoort. Then there's Jubele, which comes from Jube, and so on. For many of us who were born in urban townships like the ones in Gauteng, we are generally cut off from any knowledge of our past. The evolution of our country was such that we came from a generation of mothers and fathers who were detached from their heritage. They themselves are the children of parents who came into the cities and found themselves having to create new identities for themselves. Identities that would be acceptable to white people. Many of us in the townships don't know anyone in our family lineage beyond our grandparents. In fact, I only learned about my paternal great-grandfather just a week before I made this recording, after having spent years searching. But perhaps in all that we have gone through as a people, our greatest loss has been black men who lost themselves. And with that, the role, image, and function of fatherhood in black society. This is why whenever the topic of a surname comes up, it tends to create tension at the very least. More often than not, the topic seems to swing between two points. On the one hand, there is the issue of a person using the wrong surname. On the other hand, is a person wanting to change their surname with the hope that this would change their fortune in life. The issue of what is the correct surname to use is incredibly complicated. This is mainly due to the fact that we have such a broken generation of fathers. And this is compounded by the fact that Africans are a patriarchal and patrilineal society. In our cultures, it is believed that children should carry the surname of the father, or that it is spiritually ideal that a person carry the surname of their biological father. The challenge with this practice is that its context has shifted dramatically from its point of origin, a fish out of water in the process of dying. Many of the different aspects of our beliefs rely heavily on a specific context. The sheer number of children growing up without fathers is sucking the air out of African traditional naming systems. In fact, for many, many people, this practice is an insult. What makes it worse is that people are told that spiritually they don't have a choice but to use their father's surname, regardless of their history or their relationship. To be told that your spiritual health and future depends on you carrying the surname of a man who might have blatantly and consciously and intentionally disregarded your existence is unimaginably unfair. It turns the whole basis of so-called African spirituality into a farce, a joke even. One cannot help but question the very nature of these apparent ancestors who are willing to wreak havoc in your life, to ruin relationships and invite poverty into your life, all because of the decisions of a man who wasn't even bothered by whether or not you went to bed on an empty stomach. A man who couldn't think beyond his own selfish desires and brokenness. Or it could even be his family that scarred you and left a wound that refuses to heal. Personally, I would never force anyone or compel them to use their father's surname if it brought them pain. I think we all deserve not to be hurt, especially by things that we did not participate in. But I would like to propose a different way of looking at the issue of your surname. Right now, our limited view of the function of our surname presented as something that will do something for us should we adopt it. It is something that will unlock our earthly treasures like a lotto ticket. But imagine for a moment that your surname is like a library. A great big library with your surname in bold gold letters shining on the outside above two huge wooden doors with golden handles. Here's the thing about libraries. They don't do anything. For all the wealth of knowledge that it carries, a library does not do a single thing. The value of a library is not just in its books, but in how a person uses the knowledge within them. Your surname, as problematic as it may be to you, carries immense history. A history that goes far, far back, beyond even the existence of that surname, because this history spans thousands of years and many lifetimes. Now, somewhere in that library, on a shelf, there is a book. This book has your father's name on it. It is one book out of thousands. Maybe it is a disappointing read with an uninspiring protagonist. Maybe it is a book half lived and half empty. Maybe it's an epic that you can't put down. Or maybe it is a book that you'd rather not even touch. Nonetheless, it is just one book out of many. Changing your surname or using the so-called right surname will not heal you. Not unless you seek out the knowledge of how to do that and you go through the painstaking process of implementing that knowledge. Using the right surname might unblock certain paths and might lead to a new job, but it will not teach you financial literacy. It will not teach you self-discipline or ambition. Not unless you seek out the knowledge to do so. Using the right surname will not repair broken relationships or resolve conflicts. But the knowledge of how to do that is there, waiting for you. In this case, a healer is like a librarian. When you consult with them, they can help you navigate the library. But they cannot come in every day and read the books for you. They can guide you to some important information, but they cannot implement that information in your life. Using the right surname is not just about changing your surname to that of your biological father. Your mother's name is just as important. Your mother's lineage is equally crucial to your existence, and through her you inherit another entire library. Using the right surname is about aligning yourself with the multitude of people who came before you. It is like getting a library card. It means that you can engage with this knowledge at any point because you carry this knowledge within you. This is the knowledge of self, the basis of why you believe God placed you on this earth. Using the correct surname is to acknowledge that you are a fundamentally important branch of this tree that is your family, and that from the fruit of your labor within yourself will grow many more generations. I think this is more important for us as men, because if we want those who will come after us to carry our surnames, we need to give them a reason why. They need to want to carry our surname. We need to infuse our surname with pride and purpose and work. It is not about entitlement. I think the most important thing to understand that is that it's not about you as an individual. The hardest thing is having to look beyond your own pain and beyond your own scars and beyond your own traumas and look into the future. When we're talking about spirituality and we're talking about surnames, we are talking about the work of generations. This is not about what your surname can do for you. It's about what you can do for your descendants who are going to come 100 years from now. It's about the legacies that we leave behind. That is what a surname is. If we take pride in ourselves and the legacies that we leave behind, maybe then our descendants won't be fighting about which surname to use. Maybe we won't leave them with confusion. And maybe, just maybe, your book will be the one that is most read in the library. My name is Vusumuzi Ncande. Thank you so much for joining me on this episode. I wish you courage. And I wish you all the best on your journey. Makwande.